2005, Tui Wilshinsky joined Rosemary Manchester in a conversation about time travel and The Time Traveler's Wife, later released as a motion picture. The book's author, Audrey Niffenegger, joins Rosemary during the second half of the show. I'm Suzanne Lang. Stay tuned for this encore presentation. It's The Time Traveler's Wife on A Novel Idea. It's hard being left behind. I wait for Henry, not knowing where he is, wondering if he's okay. It's hard to be the one who stays. Long ago, men went to sea, and women waited for them, standing on the edge of the water, scanning the horizon for the tiny ship. Now I wait for Henry. He vanishes unwillingly, without warning. I wait for him. Each moment that I wait feels like an eternity. Through each moment, I can see infinite moments lined up, waiting. Why has he gone where I cannot follow?
When I am out there in time, I am inverted, changed into a desperate version of myself. I become a thief, a vagrant, an animal who runs and hides. I startle old women and amaze children. I am a trick, an illusion of the highest order, so incredible that I am actually true. Is there a logic, a rule to all this coming and going, all this dislocation? Is there a way to stay put, to embrace the present with every cell? I don't know. And Claire, always Claire. I hate to be where she is not, when she is not. And yet, I am always going, and she cannot follow.
From the opening paragraphs, the prologue of the book on which we focus this evening, The Time Traveler's Wife, by Audrey Niffenegger. Welcome to A Novel Idea. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host. My guest this evening to guide us through our own time travels is my erudite friend, Tui Wilshinsky. Tui is not a stranger to this audience, as he was here to interpret The Life of Pi and The Secret Life of Bees. Tui helps me find the inner meanings within books, and I'm delighted to have him here for this one. Welcome, Tui.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Tui is a lover of books and movies. He leads the dances of universal peace, and he tutors mathematics and science. You really cover all the bases, Tui.
I do my best.
That's remarkable. I think I heard you say that The Time Traveler's Wife is one of your favorite books.
Yes, I've been reading it for the second time now, and I'm carrying it around with me all the time. Every time I have a second break, if I'm online at the bank or waiting for somebody or, you know, having a snack, that book is in my hand and I'm reading it.
Have you had the experience of people saying to you, oh, you're reading Time Traveler's Wife? I just love that book.
Yes.
It's very interesting, isn't it? The word of mouth on this book.
Yeah. Though a lot of people think it's just straight science fiction and get turned off by that when it's not actually. It's a love story.
That's right. A love story with a difference.
Yes.
With a twist.
Big difference.
We're going to spend some time talking about the book itself, and then we're going to spend time talking about the concept of time travel. Tui knows a great deal about this, and he's been reading up on it, so I'm especially looking forward to hearing what you have to say about time travel, Tui. The book is set in Chicago, and there's a very strong sense of place. And as you say, Tui, it's a love story. I found the characters irresistible. The story opens with Claire Absher, an artist, doing research in the Newbery Library, which, of course, is in Chicago. A startling scene, which foreshadows the story, one of the librarians suggests, perhaps Mr. de Tamble can help you. And as Mr. de Tamble steps forward, Claire says, Henry! She recognizes him at once as someone she's seen before many times, but he doesn't recognize her. They make a date for that evening, and Claire tells Henry she's known him for 14 years, ever since she was 6 years old. She shows him her diary with a list, which Henry dictated to her, she says, of 152 dates on which Henry appeared or will appear to her. Henry's appearances so far have been in the meadow, a secluded clearing in Claire's backyard, an idyllic setting. In the winter, she sneaks him into the basement of the house. Now, I should mention that when Henry shows up on his time travels, he's left everything behind, including his clothes. Now, this is a challenging task the author has set for herself, to build a credible love story in which the protagonists are introduced as a precocious 6-year-old girl and a grown-up naked stranger.
I'd like to read that part when they first meet.
Please do.
She's in the meadow, and she's 6 years old playing with some crayons and pens, and she's humming the theme to the Dick Van Dyke Show. And he says, "She's obviously not waiting for me. I'm a stranger. I'm sure that the first thing you learn in first grade is not to have any truck with strangers who show up naked in your favorite secret spot and know your name and tell you not to tell your mom and dad. I wonder if today is the day we're supposed to meet for the first time, or if it's some other day. Maybe I should be very silent, and either Claire will go away, or I can munch up those apples and steal some laundry, or I will revert to my regularly scheduled programming. I snap from my reverie to find Claire staring straight at me. I realize too late that I've been humming along with her. 'Who's there?' Claire hisses. She looks like a really pissed off goose, all neck and legs. I'm thinking fast. 'Greetings, Earthling,' I intone kindly. 'Mark, you Nimrod,' she thinks it's her brother. Claire is casting about for something to throw and decides on her shoes, which have heavy, sharp heels. She whips them off and does throw them. I don't think she can see me very well, but she lucks out, and one of them catches me in the mouth. My lip starts to bleed. 'Please don't do that.' I don't have anything to staunch the blood, so I press my hand to my mouth, and my voice comes out muffled. My jaw hurts. 'Who is it?' Now Claire is frightened, and so am I. 'Henry, it's Henry, Claire. I won't hurt you. I wish you wouldn't throw anything else at me. Give me back my shoes. I don't know you. Why are you hiding?' Claire is glowering at me. I toss her shoes back into the clearing. She picks them up and stands holding them like pistols. 'I'm hiding because I lost my clothes and I'm embarrassed. I came a long way and I'm hungry and I don't know anybody and now I'm bleeding. Where did you come from? Why do you know my name?' 'The whole truth and nothing but the truth. I came from the future. I'm a time traveler.'"
It's not only a fascinating scene, but a beautiful demonstration that the technique that the author uses to incorporate specific detail, colors, scents, so many specifics in what she writes. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the things that helped me get right into this book. I didn't find myself arguing with the concept of time travel. I wasn't reading this book and saying, "Oh, come on, people don't do that." And I think it was because of these details.
Yeah.
And they just bring you right in. And you think, well, of course it happened like that.
And the time travel experience is woven through the book like a weaving.
Seamless.
It's seamless. There, it's not a MacGuffin. It's not something that's thrown in to make things make sense. It's there as the root, as the heart of this love story.
The scenes of Claire and Henry getting to know each other that take place in the meadow, they have picnics and chess games in the meadow and in the basement. That's such an interesting way for the author to introduce us to the characters.
By the time she actually meets him, when he's 28 and she's 20, you've known a lot about them through these meetings. But he doesn't know her at all when he's 20. It's his first time. But for her, it's her 152nd time.
That's right. And again, we admire the skill of the writer in not only keeping track of all the time elements, but in the credibility which she brings to the story.
It's juggled very well.
Yes.
Each chapter, in fact, is headed by their age and what time it is. So she's setting the time for each chapter, not just the location.
She's very careful to orient us in time, mm-hmm. isn't she? Mm-hmm. Maybe she's afraid we'll start traveling around within the book.
Right. Especially at those times when he meets himself.
Oh, yes. And we are going to talk about that because I just found those remarkable. Claire says that Henry keeps appearing and disappearing like the Cheshire Cat. And she asks Henry early on if he's a real person. Can he prove he's a real person? And Henry challenges her to prove that she is a real person. Now, Tui, how could you or I establish that we are real people? At this moment, we're just voices on the radio.
Well, in the book, if you remember, I think he says, pinch me. And that's supposed to be proof that one is real.
Ah.
But I don't think you're too far away to pinch
right now.
Electronically.
Yes. And
but all we have is our faith and belief that we're real people.
That's true. That stopped me cold, that question, how can you prove that you're real, when she asked him if he was a real person. Mm-hmm.
There's a story by Nasruddin. A fellow walks into the bank and they say, do you have any ID? And he pulls out a mirror and says, yep, that's me. We could use that technique.
Good luck. We learn about Henry's childhood, too, as the alternate voices of Claire and Henry tell their stories. We're not going to go into detail on the stories of Claire and Henry because we have other things that we want to highlight, and many of you have already read the book, and we hope that those of you who have not read The Time Traveler's Wife by Audrey Niffenegger will soon be on your way to the library or your favorite independent bookstore to pick up a copy and see what all the fuss is about. This is A Novel Idea on KRCB. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host. My guest is Tui Wilshinsky, and we're discussing the book The Time Traveler's Wife by Audrey Niffenegger.
I want to talk about time travel per se for a moment, if I may.
Please do.
Because there are many different theories of time travel, and Henry, one of the main characters here, is inflicted with chrono impairment or chrono displacement, and he has something like a seizure where without his willingness or knowledge, he's transported somewhere back in time or forward in time and has nothing with him and has to make do with where he is. The way Audrey Niffenegger has set this up, time is like a film strip or a river. Things have happened in the past, they happen in the present, they happen in the future, and you can visit different places. That's one kind of way of looking at time. Another way of looking at time is if it were an ever-branching tree. So every time you make a decision, every time you have a preference one way or the other, reality branches. So there are multiple levels, multiple universes based on your decisions that happen. But that's not what's going on in this one. In fact, they're very cautious not to change anything.
Could you think of reading a book as time travel? You're transported to another time, and let's say you spend an hour reading the book, but in that you could have read about 10 years in the life of someone else. So in a sense, we all time travel, do we?
Yeah, well, especially when you're reading, if you want to go back and look up a passage that you remember, it's like her idea of this river of time, this film strip, and you can look back in the past. If it wasn't like that, your book would be like one of those interactive movies where they have different endings and different beginnings and different middles where it keeps changing based on your choices.
Mm-hmm. Might be more like a blog on the internet than a book that's in another time.
Yeah.
That's an interesting concept.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk a bit more about time travel in a moment, but please feel free to introduce it at any point because I know you have many, many thoughts on it.
Sure. It's timely.
Timely. Thank you, Tui. We should mention that Claire and Henry are not isolated characters here. They have interesting families, and we get to know a great deal about their families. And Claire has good friends, Charisse and Gomez, very colorful characters. Henry's friends are less satisfactory. I think he's constrained by his habit of sudden appearance and disappearance. That would be a little difficult to form a solid friendships. But he's 8 years older than Claire, and while he's waiting for her to grow up, he has a girlfriend, Ingrid, not a particularly satisfactory partner for him. And he drops Ingrid when Claire shows up in the library that day, and then Claire's friends become his friends. And that's a very nice part of the story. Friendship and family play a surprisingly important part in this love story.
In fact, family is so important. Niffenegger says that your family is like the gravity around which you circulate. So that important events in Henry's life are the gravity places where he keeps returning to again and again, highly charged places that he keeps returning to.
Ah, and his life was certainly full of dramatic events. Mm-hmm. And you wonder if perhaps that didn't have some effect on his tendency to appear and disappear.
Yes, he tends to disappear under times of stress.
Yes.
And go to places of stress sometimes.
Yes.
Although sometimes he goes to places that are very innocuous. And he's very careful, as I said, not to try to change things. I mean, his world is such that he wants it to be predictable. He wants to meet Claire. In fact, there's a passage where she paints this picture. And can I read that passage here?
Sure.
About this experiment they try. She's about to sign this painting of him. And he says, "Don't. It's not dated." And she says, "It's not?" He says, "I've seen it before. There's no date on it." "Do you ever find that you go back to your present and something has changed?" And he says, "I mean, what if I wrote the date on this drawing right now? What would happen?" "I don't know," he says. "Try it." And she erases the date. "There, that was easy. If I violated the space-time continuum, it isn't very obvious." And he starts to disappear. But when he gets back to the future, "What happened to the date? There's no date on it." As he looks at the painting, she says, "What date? You wrote the date on the bottom, under your name. It's been trimmed off." Clara says, "Yes, I confess, I trimmed it off. I got all freaked out by your comments. I started thinking, what if we never met in the future because I insisted on testing this out? I'm glad you did. Why? I don't know. I just am. But why does it seem as though something impossible almost just happened? Why do I feel so relieved?"
Henry is also very careful not to let other people know what the future of their lives will be. And he uses his power very carefully. Only in emergencies that does he use his ability to know what's going to happen in the future. And I was impressed with that, with his self-restraint, that he could have done almost anything with his ability to predict the future, and yet he controlled it carefully.
He does say that they do finance their lifestyle by making some investments, and he helps Gomez before the internet ever happens. "Well, you should invest in certain things that involve the internet." He gives him a few clues
that's
for the
right.
future.
So he uses it when he needs to, mm-hmm. or when he wants to. Their courtship proceeds. Not like any other courtship you ever read about. And they meet each other's families and become engaged. And there's a wonderful extended scene of Christmas at Claire's home, meeting the families, some of whom feel they might have seen him before. And the author is very, very good with these complicated family scenes. I so admire the ability to do that, to present a myriad of characters in one of those long, complicated scenes.
Yeah, and all this time he's worried about popping out of existence and trying to be calm and relaxed when he's not.
And Claire is concerned about that, too. She's saying, "Don't disappear, don't disappear." She's saying it to herself, but she's almost praying that Henry will not suddenly disappear from the dinner table. And he's trying his best, but some of it is not under his control.
This idea of control is interesting because it seems like everything has happened in the past and the future, and it's kind of immutable. But at the same time, they're cautious about not changing anything. There's one theory of time travel that has to do with time being like rubber. If you try to change something, it'll snap back. There's a book called Glimpses where this guy goes back in time and tries to save various musicians who he loves from killing themselves or from dying somehow. He goes back and tries to save Jimi Hendrix, and he stops him from choking, whatever. But the next day, Jimi Hendrix gets hit by a car, and he tries to save him again. But the next day, he gets killed some other way. So this time sort of heals itself is one theory of how time can proceed, that things are immutable. But if you try to mess with things, it'll come back to how it is. On the other hand, there are theories that if you change one thing, the entire future changes.
I had no idea that there were so many theories about time travel. It's a new subject to me. And until I read this book, I really hadn't thought much about it. So I'm fascinated to find that there's a whole body of knowledge here, mm-hmm. just about time travel.
Yeah, for a long time it was just the purview of science fiction writers, but now it's entering physics, and people are doing vast mathematical calculations on the possibility of time travel, mm-hmm. especially when we think about traveling at the speed of light or close to the speed of light, or talk about neutron stars or black holes, which have such tremendous gravity fields that time bends near them.
Well, as Henry and Claire prepare for their wedding, Henry, of course, is very aware that the stress level will put him in danger of being whisked away in an important moment. And he considers taking some antipsychotic drugs. A doctor has told him that time travel is a side effect of schizophrenia. But Claire says, don't take anything. You're not sick. Claire has complete faith that they're supposed to be together. Well, isn't that how true love works?
Well, they have a very unique love, because when they meet, when she's 20 and he's 28, she's totally there. The courtship isn't even necessary, because the courtship's been going on since she was 6 years old. He's never met her before, but here she is totally present with him and totally in love with him. It's intoxicating.
It is. It's a beautiful love story, isn't it? The mm-hmm. Of course, the time travel aspect gives it a very interesting twist, but the story itself is beautiful.
And she's remarkably patient. He disappears, something happens, and she just waits around with his empty clothes, and he reappears after a certain point.
And she almost never loses her temper. I think she realizes that it's not under his control as he comes and goes.
Yeah.
The
Claire seems kind of fictional at certain points.
Too good to be true. Too good to be true. Right. Henry, on the other hand, has this moment.
He's gritty.
Yes.
Some moments are very gritty. I mean, there's one scene where he's, I guess this is typical of what happens to him. He gets arrested because he's appeared in the altogether somewhere. He's in a police car. It's warm, and I'm not in Chicago. Chicago's finest hate me because I keep disappearing while I'm in custody, and they can't figure it out. Also, I refuse to talk to them, so they still don't know who I am, where I live. The day they find out, I'm toast, because there are several outstanding warrants for my arrest: breaking and entering, shoplifting, resisting arrest, breaking arrest, trespassing, indecent exposure, robbery, and so weiter. From this, one might deduce that I'm a very inept criminal, but really, the main problem is that it's so hard to be inconspicuous when you're naked. Stealth and speed are my main assets, and so when I try to burgle houses in broad daylight, stark naked, sometimes it doesn't work out. I've been arrested 7 times, and so far I've always vanished before they can fingerprint me or take a photo. And he's trained his feet to be very hard like leather, because he has to be able to run.
The account of their wedding is just not to be missed. If you've already read the book, read that part again, because you'll just be amazed how much comes through the second time you might have missed the first time. And if you haven't read the book, we don't want to give away too much of the story. But Claire and Henry move into a small apartment in which the second bedroom becomes Claire's studio, and it's far from adequate for her work. I want you to hear the soliloquies of Claire and Henry as they muse on their married life.
I am having a hard time in my tiny back bedroom studio in the beginning of my married life. The space that I call mine, that isn't full of Henry, is so small that my ideas have become small. The compelling thing about making art, or making anything, I suppose, is the moment when the vaporous, insubstantial idea becomes a solid there, a thing, a substance in a world of substances. And what of Henry? Henry is an artist of another sort, a disappearing artist. Our life together in this too small apartment is punctuated by Henry's small absences. Sometimes he disappears unobtrusively. I might be walking from the kitchen into the hall and find a pile of clothing on the floor. I might get out of bed in the morning and find the shower running and no one in it. Sometimes it's frightening. I am working in my studio one afternoon when I hear someone moaning outside my door. When I open it, I find Henry on his hands and knees, naked in the hall, bleeding heavily from his head. He opens his eyes, sees me, and vanishes. Sometimes I wake up in the night and Henry is gone. In the morning, he will tell me where he's been, the way other husbands might tell their wives a dream they've had. I am waiting for Henry to tell me that he has seen me as a child, but so far this hasn't happened. When I was a child, I looked forward to seeing Henry. Every visit was an event. Now, every absence is a non-event, a subtraction. An adventure I will hear about when my adventurer materializes at my feet, bleeding or whistling, smiling or shaking. Now I am afraid when he is gone.
When you live with a woman, you learn something every day. So far, I have learned that long hair will clog up the shower drain before you can say liquid plumber, that it is not advisable to clip something out of the newspaper before your wife has read it, even if the newspaper in question is a week old, that I am the only person in our two-person household who can eat the same thing for dinner 3 nights in a row without pouting. The hardest lesson is Claire's solitude. Sometimes I come home and Claire seems kind of irritated. I've interrupted some train of thought, broken into the dreamy silence of her day. Sometimes I see an expression on Claire's face that is like a closed door. She's gone inside the room of her mind and is sitting there knitting or something. I've discovered that Claire likes to be alone. But when I return from time traveling, she is always relieved to see me.
When Claire and Henry decide to have a baby, the story turns dark. Claire suffers a series of miscarriages. Henry seeks help from a neurologist, but we're not giving away too much when we tell you that at last they have a daughter whose name is Alba, and she is, of course, the joy of their lives, a delightful character in her own right, and yes, a time traveler. I think it's time we heard from the author, Audrey Niffenegger. In the prologue, you mentioned that you would like to thank the librarians of the reference desk at the Evanston Public Library for their patient assistance with what you call all sorts of wacko questions. I'd love to know what some of those wacko questions were.
It's fading and receding with time, I'm afraid. But, you know, I would call them up and ask them things like, how do you spell lazy boy? They helped me check all the nitty-gritty when I was fact-checking and editing the book with the editor and the copy editors. They were invaluable because they would answer anything over the phone and they would go and look it up for you. And it meant that I didn't have to slog all the time.
And you set the story in Chicago, a city that you obviously know very well.
I've lived either in Chicago or near Chicago my entire life. I never ran away to the circus or went to New York or anything like that.
There's a tremendous sense of place in the book. I really felt that I had a pretty good hold on Chicago by the time I finished the book.
Well, what's been amazing to me is that I hear via either people emailing me or just, you know, anecdotes that people have started to come to Chicago and go to these various spots that are in the book. People at the Newbery tell me that folks show up at the Newbery and ask to see the cage. I mean, the people at the Newbery are all kind of bemused by this because the cage is just this really boring stairwell that they never thought twice about.
Well, Henry, the charming librarian, is in love with Claire Absher, who's a paper artist. Mm-hmm. I notice that you teach in the MFA program at Columbia College Chicago Center for Book and Paper Arts. Mm-hmm. So it's more than just a coincidence that Claire is a paper artist, right?
Yeah, I mean, this book is not autobiography. I mean, beyond the obvious that I'm not a time traveler and neither is my boyfriend, what I was doing was using all these things that are very familiar to me to give the book as much of a sense of realness as I could impart. And so even though I'm not actually a paper artist, a lot of people close to me are. And so I just kind of stepped over slightly. I mean, what I actually do is I'm a printer and printmaker and work with artist books and things like that. So even though I'm not very good at papermaking. When I need paper, I can just turn to my friends and say, hey, would you make this for me? I mean, anybody who's part of a nexus or a community of scholars or artists or anything like that, I mean, musicians, you sort of know the value of synergy. You know, to have all these people gathered in one place is really terrific. And so the passages in the book where Claire is actually making something, I mean, that comes from my own experience as an artist, but the particulars of it, like, you know, how do you beat a pound of abaca? I had to go to my friends and say, hey, how do you do this?
And you knew how important it was to Claire to have her own studio so that she could do her work.
A big theme in Claire's life is the difference between solitude and being alone. I mean, she doesn't necessarily like being left by Henry, but she does get a lot out of her aloneness in that it allows her to make her work.
When Claire and Henry meet for the first time in real time in the library, and that evening, Claire shows Henry a list of all the times they would meet, mm-hmm. a list that Henry dictated to Claire when she was 6 years old. It was so complicated to keep track of their meetings. I imagined a huge chart on your wall.
A lot of people seem to want there to be that. It was actually in the computer. It wasn't very glamorous to look at all. There are actually two timelines that I use to keep track of things, and one is Claire's timeline, which is also the reader's timeline, since Claire and the reader share their experience of time. And the other one was to keep track of what the reader knows at any given moment in the book and where Henry's jumping from when he time travels.
And you refer to the list as a Mobius strip. That is, I believe, a strip that has no beginning and no ending?
Yeah, it's completely continuous.
Yeah, from Escher, I think. That was a nice clue that you planted early on. So I knew it was going to be complex.
Yeah. Well, I think some people are daunted at the beginning. They're thinking, oh, my God, I've got to take notes. I actually met one woman who showed me her copy, and she had taken copious notes in the back pages of the book, trying to keep track of everything. And really, it would be better just to read the book and let it flow. And then if you wanted to, you could, you know, read it again and keep track of how everything fits together. But it isn't really essential for experiencing the book that you understand every little piece of the puzzle. It was written completely out of order. I mean, the way I wrote it is not the way that a reader experiences it. And so I think, in a way, that the book just kind of hits the ground running. When I look back on it, I realize that I pretty much just expected the reader to drop into it like Henry drops into his time travel. Just plop, here you go. Okay, let's run.
Well, and, I for one did just drop into it. I didn't spend any time trying to figure out how he did it.
Fabulous.
I was just caught up in the story of the two lovers, and it seemed perfectly natural that Henry would appear and disappear. And I think that one of the reasons I was so caught up was because of your use of specific detail of their lives, what they ate, where they lived, their friends, their families.
Well, of course, that's what you are always telling student writers to do, you know, to really ground it in the nitty-gritty and give it texture and realness. And so that's what I was attempting to do. And it made them more real for me as well.
Their courtship is really complicated, and they learn to trust each other. And then they marry and decide to have a child, and this causes Henry to begin a search for genetic clues to his ability to travel in time. He was rather harsh with the doctor that he wanted to work with, and it gave you some idea of the power of his motivation. He could be quite ruthless when great things were at stake.
I think also that when you are an exception to the rule, you know, when you're extraordinary in some way, that perhaps that makes you a little impatient sometimes with people who have to follow the rules. I mean, Henry is sometimes a little callous, and the experiences that he and Kendrick have together are a good example of Henry just kind of riding roughshod over somebody in order to try to achieve something.
Yes, that was interesting to see that side of Henry. I think one of the reasons that people love this book is that it concerns a love affair that lasts a lifetime. And I wondered, when you wrote the story, if you didn't also have us ordinary people in mind, those of us who don't travel back and forth through time as Henry did, but feel ourselves changing over time in our relationships.
Well, it can really only be about that. I mean, there's no point in writing about, you know, Martian love or something, because we don't care. You know, we want to see our own experiences reflected in fiction. And when you use a device that's sort of extraordinary, you have to use it as a metaphor for people's real experience, or it will just be a parlor trick. No one will care. And so all the things that happened to Henry and Claire could easily be the story of anybody's actual life, except for that they are experiencing it in this kind of shuffled way that causes them to know things they shouldn't necessarily know and to have glimpses of things they don't want to know. But emotionally, it's true.
Would it be unfair to say that this story is a metaphor?
Oh, no, not at all. It has to be there. I mean, I was thinking of the time travel as being, first of all, a metaphor for memory. In many cases in the book, it's used almost the way that another writer would use flashbacks or characters' recollection. At the beginning of writing, I read this big pile of popular books about physics and genetics. And what's always impressive to me is how poetic science is. And I always think it's a pity that there's this sort of separation between people in the arts and people in the sciences, because there seems to be so much potential when you think about it. I mean, science is essentially about finding out the truth about what the world is, and fiction, hopefully, is about finding out the truth about what we are, and it seems like those two things ought to intersect a lot more than they do. I'm a math ignoramus, and so I can't really get into the language of physics, which of course is math. But just to understand the concepts or try to get a grip on the concepts, I kept thinking, well, this thing that I'm doing is really not that far-fetched. You know, when you think about relativity or something, it's not so far outside reality.
That was Audrey Niffenegger, the author of The Time Traveler's Wife. I spoke with her by phone. We're discussing her book tonight on A Novel Idea. This is your host, Rosemary Manchester, and now we're going to take a short break.
Yeah, I see conclusion in all this confusion. Though you and I both know it's only the warm glow of wine. That's got you to feeling this way. But I don't care, I want you to stay. Just to hold me and tell me.
About time travel, Tuli.
Okay. One of the latest theories has to do with something called the Einstein-Rosen bridge, which is a construct that happens, which we call a wormhole. It's a way of going from one part of the universe to another, from one part of time to another, or space. We live in a universe that has three dimensions of space and one of time, but there could be other dimensions that have other universes that have different dimensions of time and space. But this is the one we're stuck with. And supposedly this Einstein-Rosen bridge is a way of making transitions. But you have to carry around a black hole with you, which is millions of times denser than the sun and not very convenient to have in your pocket.
Do you think that for many of us in the Western world with our linear thinking, do you think that makes it more difficult for us to accept these concepts of time travel?
Well, if you think linearly, we run into paradox. Niffenegger, she sidesteps that entire process. Every time Henry goes back in time and meets himself, there's no problem with it. But traditional science fiction writers are always dealing with paradox. One of the classic ones has to do is with, if let's say you went back in time and your time machine landed on your grandfather and killed your grandfather, and you'd never be born to get in the time machine and go back and kill your grandfather. But then you would be born, so you would, and then you wouldn't, so you wouldn't. It's a loop of logic that just devours itself.
What she calls a Mobius strip.
Yeah.
Early on, yes.
Right, right. Uh-huh. It's kind of like if you had your bike was stolen and you had the ability to go back in time and warn yourself to lock your bike up, and you went back in time and locked your bike up, your bike wouldn't get stolen. Therefore, you'd have no motivation to go back in time to lock your bike up. And that paradox is what disturbs a lot of time travel theories, that the linear way that we think things proceed gets caught in this Mobius strip and twisted around.
I found one of the most difficult things to get my mind around were the times that Henry encountered himself.
Yes, there's an exquisite time. I think it's the first time he goes back and when he meets himself. He's about 6 years old.
Oh, yes, the scene in the Field Museum, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
And he's teaching young Henry how to become a pickpocket, because when he does travel in time, he has to know how to break into houses to find clothes. He has to get pickpocket people to get money so we can buy clothes and get along. So he's teaching young Henry how to become a pickpocket, and young Henry succeeds. And then young Henry says, Henry, I don't like to time travel by myself. It's better with you. Can't you always come back with me? And the older Henry is looking at the younger Henry, and he reflects. He is standing with his back to me, and we look at each other in the mirror. Poor small self. At this age, my back is thin, and my shoulder blades stick out like insipid wings. He turns, waiting for an answer, and I know what I have to tell him. Me. I reach out and gently turn him and bring him to stand by me, so we are side by side, heads level, facing the mirror. Look. We study our reflections, twinned in the ornate gilt of the bathroom splendor. Our hair is the same brown-black. Our eyes slant dark and fatigue-ringed identically. We support exact replicas of each other's ears. I'm taller and more muscular and shave. He's slender and ungainly and is all knees and elbows. I reach up and pull my hair back from my face. I show him the scar from the accident. Unconsciously, he mimics my gesture, touches the same scar on his own forehead. It's just like mine, he says. How did you get it? The same as you. It is the same. We are the same. It is a translucent moment. I didn't understand, and then I did. Just like that. I watched it happen. I want to be both of us at once. I want to feel again the feeling of losing the edges of myself, of seeing the admixture of future and present for the first time. But I'm too accustomed. I'm too comfortable with it. And so I am left on the outside, remembering the wonder of being 9 and suddenly seeing, knowing that my friend, my guide, my brother, was me. Me, only me, and the loneliness of it.
Is it a similar experience when we look at photographs of ourselves as children and can remember the time that photograph was taken and the circumstances, and do we perhaps for a moment slip back into time to that child that we were? Is that an example of time travel?
I think it's even more effective when you look at videos. They weren't around when I was a kid. People had cameras, but I don't have motion pictures of myself when I was a kid. But my daughters when they were younger, I took videotapes of them. And I wonder what it's like when they look at themselves as younger people and how that feels to see yourself in the younger body moving and doing things and reacting to the world. Maybe when we had experiences, we really noted them, really concentrated, because this was the only time it was going to happen. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was the first time you heard a song and you took it to your heart because it wasn't going to be recorded. Mm-hmm. Or the first time you saw someone's face, you made the picture yourself.
That's one thing you notice about Claire and Henry. They're really, really focused. They're both so aware of the elusiveness of their time together that they don't wander off. They stay pretty much focused on themselves and each other.
Yes, being doing simple things is so precious to them. He talks about just, you know, sitting in an easy chair reading a book is his greatest pleasure. Not traveling, not moving through time, not having to outrun the cops or find clothing or be cold.
Mm-hmm. Well, perhaps you could say that the experience of being present in time is something that we would value more if we focused more on it. And instead of constantly thinking of rushing ahead to the next thing or thinking about what we did yesterday, I know that in meditation techniques, one trains oneself to be present in the moment.
Yeah. Be here now because you can't be here later.
You're listening to A Novel Idea. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host. My guest is Tui Wilshinsky. We're discussing the book The Time Traveler's Wife by Audrey Niffenegger. Learning so many already, so many lessons from the concept of time travel that it's. I also find that since I've read this book, I find the words time everywhere in what I read, and I'm so much more conscious of the concept of time since I read The Time Traveler's Wife.
Yeah, it's also a stretchy medium. When I lived up in Juneau for a while, in the wintertime, the sun is only below the horizon for about an hour. And when you say, guess I'll fix the lawnmower after dinner, you've got 7 hours of light after dinner. So things take their time and go much slower than someplace that's more temperate where you have a certain fixed time and the sun's going to go down.
No, I had a similar experience. I spent a summer in Sitka, and I remember the disorientation of those long, long hours of daylight. Took a bit of getting used to.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask you about this. As time goes on, there's time again, Henry's time travel changes and becomes more and more dangerous and life-threatening. Now, we were talking about the mischievous six-year-old in the Field Museum, and then we think of the poor fellow freezing in the Monroe Street parking garage. What's that all about? How that that changes as he ages?
Henry says, I find myself in situations that are difficult all the time. No pun intended, he says. There's something wrong with me. I get dislocated in time for no reason. I can't control it. I never know when it's going to happen, where or when I'll end up. So in order to cope, I pick locks, I shoplift, I pick pockets, I mug people, I panhandle, I break and enter, I steal cars, I lie, fold, spin, and mutilate. You name it, I've done it. He has to get along as best he can. This is a condition of his life, of being transported other places, and he has to make do with what he has.
So simply the passage of time causes him to be more violent and aggressive in his own life, and that in turn is reflected in the situations into which he time travels.
I think it's more the opposite, that the difficulties he runs into makes him more anxious.
I see.
I don't think he gets more violent in his—he treasures his normal life.
Because he's basically a lovely, lovely person, mm-hmm. but the circumstances of suddenly being transported into danger change him.
Yeah.
he fears then for Alba, for his daughter, who's also a time traveler, and does everything that he can to prepare Alba and Claire for the time when he'll be gone, because he knows, of course, he doesn't have long to live, that his years are numbered, literally.
Well, it's interesting saying that, because if time is always happening all the time, everything that ever was and everything that ever will be, he's always alive. You know, he's always going to be meet Claire in the meadow. He'll always be meeting her for the first time. So all time is happening all the time.
Just as we have that lovely scene near the end where Claire is old, and he travels into the future to see Claire as an old woman. That was a beautiful scene.
Yes, I wasn't going to give it away, but
it was so so moving.
It was lovely,
and I found it very comforting, because it was so sad after Henry died. And. And it was 2 years before Claire went back to work, making sculptures of the paper which she made.
But did he die? I mean, what
did he die?
What time? You know, when is he alive?
What makes you think he died? Right?
Yeah, there's a point where Claire says, "Sometimes you tell me something, and I feel like the future is already here. You know, like my future has happened in the past, and I can't do anything about it." He says, "That's called determinism. It haunts my dreams." She says, "Why?" "Well, if you're feeling boxed in by the idea that your future is unalterable, imagine how I feel. I'm constantly running up against the fact that I can't change anything, even though I'm right here watching it. I can only do things that work toward what has already happened."
And after Henry's death, if he died, these 2 years when Claire can't work, and then at the point where she goes going to go back to her work, she says, "Time, let me vanish. Then what we separate by our very presence can come together." That, there's so much in those two sentences that I'm still not sure I understand them, but it's to me that was very moving when she was trying to come to terms with the concept of time.
Yeah. Her whole life was wrapped around Henry.
That's right.
And knowing the future when she was six, knowing that they were going to be meeting many times, knowing they'd get married. Mm-hmm. And when he's not on the scene, which he isn't a lot because she's disappearing, so she's somewhat used to it. But when he disappears for a long time, her life kind of is on hold. It's the love story is so exquisite. It's something you want to wrap yourself up in.
Yes, you want to savor the love story.
Yeah, and their dialogue, the way they talk to each other is wonderful.
Beautiful. There's much, much more to say about time travel and about the book we've been discussing, The Time Traveler's Wife by Audrey Niffenegger, but we are out of time. My guest tonight...
Impossible.
My guest tonight has been Tui Wilshinsky. Thank you, Tui, for sharing your insight. I know you put in many hours to prepare for this program. I want to thank Audrey Niffenegger, the author of this marvelous book, for granting us an interview and sharing her insights on the book with us. And thank the producer, Suzanne Lang, and Katie Stolman for her post-production work. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host for A Novel Idea, reminding you that there's no such thing as too many books. We'll see you another time.
I have known you all my life. In fact, I knew you long before. 100 years or so of you. Sometimes I don't know who you are. Sometimes I don't know why you stay. All I know is when I called, you came. sunshine on my floor. You're the book I've halfway read. You're the smile a stranger gave. How can they know what it's like?